We're working on the Book of the Twelve, and this is one of the Twelve, often called the Minor Prophets. This is the second in the sequence. If we start with Obadiah, written about 845, then we move to Joel, written in about 835, between 835 and 817. And in verse 1, the word of the Lord that came to Joel, that is the debar, the word, the speech. This is the verbal revelation. This is the language of God that came to Joel, the son of Pethuel. In verse 2, hear this, O elders. So this is the speech. It's a speech that is not directed to the king of Israel, because more than likely at this time, this is the period after Queen Athaliah had all of the royal house slayed, except for one little baby boy that was hidden in the temple named Joash. And so at this time, there was no king. It was ruled by the elders. So the speech is directed toward them. And listen, all inhabitants of the land. Now, perhaps then, since it says all inhabitants of the land, it's directed toward both northern and southern kingdoms, all who lived in the land. And this is followed then by a series of rhetorical questions. These are the kinds of questions that make you think. They make you ponder. They're designed to get your mental juices flowing, so you're a part of the dialogue. And he asks, has anything like this happened in your days or your father's days? Surely they had heard of the locust plague in Egypt, you know, centuries before. Now they were facing a locust plague as well. And one of the questions commentators struggle over here in chapter 1 is whether the locust plague is something in the past or whether it's something in the future. And it seems likely to me that the plague is past, and they are in a crisis situation agriculturally and economically. So the verses that follow describe a past day of the Lord. Obadiah had mentioned the day of the Lord in verse 15 of his book, but Joel uses the phrase five times, and he actually sets out to develop that concept. That is the theme of the book, the day of the Lord. It is a day when God catastrophically intervenes into the course of history on such a scale that his sovereignty is undeniable. And therefore, he alone is God, and he alone should be worshipped. So these catastrophes are so great that people would like to forget them. The carnal mind is prone, we know, to distort and to twist the truth. So God tells them, tell your sons about it. Let your sons tell their sons and their sons the next generation. In other words, make sure this is remembered in history, because this is a punishment for sin. And if you want to avoid future plagues and punishment, discipline, then that depends on you being obedient to God or not. So fathers should teach their sons, and sons should remember history. What's the old quote? You know, those who forget the past are condemned to repeat it. And we would not want this to be repeated. So Israel's history is to be remembered because it's a track record. It's a track record of Israel's failure to obey in the Mosaic Covenant and God's faithfulness to discipline them when he said he would, or bless them when he said he would. God had warned them in Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28, two chapters you're going to get very tired of hearing about because they're so crucial to understanding the Old Testament. I hope you can never forget them. That he would bless them if they obeyed, but if they disobeyed, he would curse them. One of the cursings was a locust plague actually mentioned in Deuteronomy 28, verse 38, hundreds of years before this happened. And verse 4 describes this plague. What the gnawing locust has left, the swarming locust has eaten. What the swarming locust has left, the creeping locust has eaten. And what the creeping locust has left, the stripping locust has eaten. Now those are four Hebrew words used of the locust. And what they signify is four successive waves of locusts that God sovereignly brought to the land of Israel to wipe out their agricultural produce. And the effects of the devastation affect, you know, different people, different groups, different ways. And it begins in verse 5 with the drunkards. And they are commanded to awake. And drunks usually lay in bed all day, sleeping off a hangover or something. Not caring what really goes on around them in the world. Not caring about anybody except themselves. But now they are to awake and weep and wail, all you wine drinkers, on account of the sweet wine that is cut off from your mouth. Now apparently the sweet wine was the most prized among the drunkards. We see some things about sweet wine in Acts chapter 2 verse 13 as we're studying in the main service. That they supposed that those who spoke in tongues had been drinking sweet new wine, glucose. Where do we get glucose from? Which is a sugar. And apparently now they're not going to be able to get drunk anymore. They can't anesthetize themselves to the pain. One of the key pagan tactics for coping with sufferings in our lives is just to anesthetize myself. You know, I'll take drugs, I'll get drunk, you know, I'll get involved in musical ecstasy, drown out all my problems through that, or sexual ecstasy. Something, anything that will numb my brain to reality, the suffering that I'm facing. And that's what these Israelis were doing. They were anesthetizing their mind so they didn't have to think about Bible doctrine. But now they're not going to be able to get drunk because all the vineyards that provided the alcohol are demolished. And they're going to have to think about Bible doctrine or find another anesthetization technique. So weep and wail because you can't get your anesthetic, for a nation has invaded my land. And notice that God calls it His land. This is my land. You know, Israel were the tenants of the land, and they were responsible to maintain it and take care of it. But God is the owner of the land, and He gives it to whom He wishes, and He has given it to them. They are His tenants. Of course, the locusts here are figuratively called a nation, for they have a destructive force like a human army. Mighty and without number, He says. We said there are going to be billions of these locusts in these swarms when they get agitated and go to find food. It says its teeth are the teeth of a lion, and it has the fangs of a lioness. And the locusts, here's one here, they're about 3 inches long, about 4-inch wingspan. They have these little saw-like teeth that rip apart vegetation, a lot like a lion's teeth can rip apart flesh. He says, it has made my vine a waste and my fig tree splinters. Note again, they are God's vine and they are God's fig tree. And the vine and the fig tree were symbols of God's blessing of Israel. But once they're stripped bare and by the locust, it's a symbol of His cursing. It, that is the nation of locusts, has stripped them bare and cast them away. Their branches have become white. And we know the fourth locust there targeted the bark. I mean, it stripped it down to no bark. Second group, addressed in verse 8, are probably the inhabitants of Jerusalem. They're the city dwellers. And He tells them to wail like a virgin girded with sackcloth for the bridegroom of her youth. Now, this is an extremely rare and bitter event where a virgin would lose her bridegroom on the wedding day. It's an extremely rare and bitter, bitter event. And it's the day when she's dressed in her wedding gown. And at the end of the day, she's dressed not in a wedding gown, but in sackcloth. Because her to-be husband was killed on that very day. And the parallel is clear. Yeah. We've seen and we've heard about locust plagues. But we've never seen anything like this. This is extremely rare and an extremely bitter locust plague. Why is it so horrible? Verse 9 says, the grain offering and the drink offering are cut off from the house of the Lord. See, these are the daily sacrifices in the Solomonic Temple. And those sacrifices, I mean, it was like clockwork. It set the rhythm of the whole nation and their life. But the locusts had so devastated the land that the daily rhythm of life had been interrupted. The priests mourn, he says, the ministers of the Lord. Now the priests mourned obviously for themselves because first of all they lived off the portion that people brought to the temple. I mean, that's how they got food. There's a portion for them. Well, now they don't have food, but they're also mourning for those who could now not approach God through sacrifice. The field is ruined, he says. The land mourns, for the grain is ruined. The new wine dries up. Fresh oil fails. So those last three things there, grain, wine, and oil, those were all essential to temple worship, used every day in the temple. And some commentators think that what this is really describing is a drought that accompanied the locust plague. But I think it's what they had done is they had stored up grain and wine and fresh oil, and it got used up so that now they don't have any left. The third group in verse 11 are the farmers and the vine dressers. These were the peasants. They didn't own any land. They worked the surrounding land. He says, "Be ashamed, O farmers, wail, O vine dressers, for the wheat and the barley, because the harvest of the field is destroyed." So there'd be no wheat or barley coming in. Now wheat was a more valuable thing, more valuable than barley because you could make really good bread with the wheat. The barley was the grain used by the poor people. And he says, the vine dries up. That is, here the word for dries up in Hebrew means to wither. You know, the vines just withered after the locust destruction. They didn't start sprouting anything new. The fig tree fails. That means it became exhausted. It doesn't produce anything else that year. I don't know about the next year. The pomegranate, the palm tree also, the apple tree, all the trees of the field dry up or wither. So these are the orchards. The beautiful orchards. I mean, you can still see beautiful orchards today in Israel. Massive orchards. And who was it telling me? I think it was Paul Kager was telling me that Germany gets a lot of their fruits from Israel. And today, and think of all those orchards, you know, withering. All the possibility, you know, now devastated. He says, indeed, rejoicing dries up from the sons of men. So harvest time in Israel was a time of great rejoicing. But when there's no harvest, there is no rejoicing. It dries up. The fourth group are the priests in verse 13. Gird yourself with sackcloth and lament, O priests. So they're to take off their fancy, beautiful ceremonial garments and put on this coarse, black sackcloth. And this signified this deep inner remorse over what had gone on in the nation, the sin of the nation. They were to lament because due to the locust plague, no sacrifices could be offered. And that meant something very crucial. If you could not offer daily sacrifices in the temple, that meant fellowship with God was cut off. You could not draw near to God. Wail, O ministers of the altar. Come, spend the night in sackcloth, O ministers of my God. Now, this is a command to the ministers from Joel. He's commanding the priests. And that's because the prophets had authority over the priests. Because prophets were the mouthpiece of God. And so he tells them to spend the night in the sackcloth. Verse 14, the priests were to consecrate a fast, proclaim a solemn assembly. So the whole nation was to rush to Jerusalem without stopping at McDonald's to get something to eat. They were to go straight to Jerusalem and proclaim a solemn, because this was a solemn situation. Only one other day of the year were they required to fast, and that's called the day of Yom Kippur. You might remember the 1973 in Israel when they were attacked in 1973. It was on the day of Yom Kippur. And that's the Day of Atonement, described in Leviticus 16. So the priests were to summon the elders, all the inhabitants of the land, to the temple in Jerusalem. They were to fast and have this assembly, and there they were to cry out to Yahweh. Cry out to Him in godly repentance and prayer that He might forgive them and restore them to blessing. So verses 1 through 14 describe what we're saying is a past day of the Lord when the land was invaded by four successive waves of locusts that caused agricultural and economic losses. But the greater thing that was lost was that the Jewish daily life that surrounded the Solomonic Temple. And just remember, it is at the very center of Jewish life. It was in when they set up the tabernacle before they had a temple. It was the 12 tribes were camped around it. It was at the very center of life. And now that has been cut off. The worship of God has been cut off. But so now the nation was cut off from fellowship with God. In fact, their hearts had become so rotten with sin that God wouldn't accept their offering. And that's why He cut this off. I don't want your offering. What I want is inner repentance. I want a true change to take place. I want you to realize the atrocity of your sin, the wickedness, the horrendousness of your sin. And I want the nation to come together and repent. And if they did, of course, they would be restored to fellowship and divine blessing. Now, there's some disagreement on verses 15 through 20. Most say this is just descriptive of the past day of the Lord. We're just going to continue to talk about some of the effects of the locust invasion. A few take it that this is describing actually the future day of the Lord, and that's what I take it as referring to. Something that's still future from our day. And I do that because while there are certain things in verses 16 and 17 and 18 that could refer to a locust plague, I find it a little bit hard to see how verse 17 talks about the barns being torn down. We don't really know of any activity of locusts doing things like that. And verses 19 and 20, the fire devouring pastures and flames devouring trees. Now, that doesn't sound like locusts. It sounds more to me like the fiery judgments of the tribulation. So the difficulty with the view I'm taking, however, is obviously these past tenses, see, that he keeps referring to. Through this, everything's like in a past tense. But that could be what we call a prophetic perfect. And I'll explain that in a minute. So I think verse 15 is shifting from Joel's day to a future day. But I'm not going to be real dogmatic about that. The other problem with my view would be there in verse 19, you see Joel crying out, you know. And Joel's obviously living in the past, not in the future. But it could also be explained by a prophetic future, as if he was removed to the future, as if he were seeing this future day. So we'll talk about that in a second. But alas for the day, verse 15, for the day of the Lord is near. Now notice it hadn't come yet. Now the locust plague, I'm saying, has already come. But the day of the Lord he's talking about here is near. And that word near is the Hebrew word karob. Q-A-R-O-B. And when we read that, we think, oh, well, that means it's just a few days away. You know, this thing's coming in next week or something. But the noun actually has the meaning of an imminent event. Something that can happen at any moment. It's something that's certain to occur, but uncertain when it will occur. It could occur in the near future, or it could occur in the far future, but it will occur. We just don't know when. From God's perspective, it's an imminent event. It can just fall, befall. We learn more about that day in the New Testament. And it will come as destruction from the Almighty. And the Hebrew word there for destruction is shod, S-H-O-D. The Hebrew word for Almighty is Shaddai, S-H-A-D-D-I-A-I. And so that's a play on words. It's saying the day of the Lord will be shod from Shaddai. It will be destruction from the destroyer, the Almighty, the powerful one and true God. Now, obviously, anyone who reads the word Shaddai, Almighty, can see what attribute of God is being referred to. You know, and it's obvious that it's what? Sovereignty or omnipotence. You know, these kinds of things. That God is sovereign, God is powerful, and that's the key, one of the keys to the book. So the day of the Lord here is the future tribulation, I take it, the judgment phase of the day of the Lord. So this is a picture, the picture Joel is painting. Let's see, did I get this? Oh, you got to be kidding. Oh, there it is. Okay. This is the picture where Joel is painting. That in the past, you have a past day of the Lord, and that like the judgment, and that's the near prophecy of Joel 1:1-14, or the near event. And then in the future day of the Lord, this is what he's talking about, the global, this is local locust plague, this is global locust judgments during the tribulation. Both are days of darkness, both are judgments, but this one's in the distant future. Okay, and when we talk about the future day of the Lord, we talk about it in two big phases. The tribulation phase, which we say is judgment, and it's 7 years. And then we talk about the blessing phase. It's always called a day of light, and it happens for 1,000 years. And then there's an aspect right in between, in the red here, and that's called something like the great and terrible day of the Lord, or great and awesome day of the Lord. And that refers to the actual day of the second coming. And it splits those 2 days apart from one another. The day of darkness and the day of light are separated by that event. Okay? So, let's look at the devastation of the tribulation just in general here in verses 16 through 20. Has not food been cut off from before our eyes? Okay, now that does happen with the locusts. They get the food, right? But it also happens in the future tribulation. If you look at Revelation 6:6 and 8, you have famine that occurs in the tribulation. You have pestilence as a result of that. But the question is, what about the past tense? Has not food been cut off before our eyes? Well, in the Hebrew, the past tense here is what we call a perfect tense. And the perfect usually means that what you have is a past event that has ongoing results. It's a past event that was completed. You did it. But it has ongoing results. But this could be what we call a prophetic perfect. A prophetic perfect means that it launches you into the future to speak as if these events are so certain that we can talk about them as if they're already done, as if they're already accomplished. That is the certainty. Okay, when they use the prophetic perfect, they're saying this is so certain we can talk about it as if it's already done before it's even happened. And we know that that's the fact because he's already given us a past locust plague, and that is the guarantee or the token judgment where the real biggie, this global one, is still in the future. But because he did this local judgment, that guarantees the futurity of this future one, and he can speak about it as if it's already done. Then he says, gladness and joy from the house of our God have been cut off. Now, if this is the future tribulation, okay, when gladness and joy are cut off from the house of our God, then house of our God there refers to the future tribulation temple and not to Solomon's temple. So this would refer to the midpoint of the tribulation when temple worship will be shut down by the Antichrist and then all hell is going to break loose on earth. At least, especially for Israel. Verse 17, the seeds shrivel under their clods. That doesn't sound like what locusts cause, but that sounds like what lack of rain causes. A drought would cause that. And we know that in the tribulation there are these two guys, we call them the two witnesses. And in Revelation 11, verse 6, it says that they will have the power to shut up the sky so that rains do not fall from heaven. They can cause drought whenever they want to. And that could be the cause of this drought. We said a few weeks ago these two witnesses could be Moses and Elijah. They could just be two new Jewish men who've never been a part of history. But the best candidates are Moses and Elijah. Elijah never died. And Michael and the angel Michael and Satan argued about Moses' body. So there's some strange things, at least, that happened with those two gentlemen. Of course, there's strange things that happened with Enoch, too, the guy before the flood, who walked with God for 350 years, and then he was not. So there are other strange individuals that could possibly be one of these candidates. The storehouses are desolate. The barns are torn down. Because of the drought brought on by the two witnesses during the tribulation, people are going to savagely steal food and destroy the storehouses and barns. For the grain is dried up. I mean, there's nothing to eat. And this could be, as I said before, referring to the third seal in the tribulation, which is in Revelation 6:6, where you have famine. And actually, it states there in Revelation 6:6 that it affects the wheat and the barley, remarkably. Verse 18 has an interesting note about the effects of human sin on nature. How the beasts groan. You know, God's concerned about the beasts. The herds of cattle wander aimlessly because there's no pasture for them. Even the flocks of sheep suffer. So, you know, back in the garden when man fell, nature fell. And when man sins, nature's affected by sin. We are the ultimate cause of suffering and pain. We are responsible for it because we sinned in Adam. And every time we commit more sin, all we do is add misery to misery in the world. And so that's what we're seeing here, nature suffering because of man's sin. Verse 19, to you, O Lord, I cry. So this is Joel, obviously, removed to the future if this is a prophetic perfect, crying as if he were in the midst of these tribulation judgments. The locust plague of his day obviously pales in comparison to what is going to happen. For fire has devoured the pastures of the wilderness, and the flame has burned up all the trees of the field. Now, this could be a direct reference to Revelation 8, verse 7, where a third of the earth is burned up, a third of the trees, and all the green grass. But I have a serious problem trying to interpret that to refer to a locust plague. How would they burn up the earth? Verse 20, even the beasts of the field pant for you, for the water brooks are dried up, and fire has devoured the pastures of the wilderness. So again, nature here, the beasts are panting for God. You know, that is remarkable. And it's as if the coming of the Messiah is just around the corner. And they're panting for Him. They're longing for Him. And it's a stark reminder of Romans 8, where Paul said that the whole creation groans as it suffers the pains of childbirth and longs to be set free from the futility. We were the ones that subjected nature to the futility. And when the redemption of man comes at the coming of the Messiah, then of course redemption comes for nature as well in the millennial kingdom. So now let's move to the demon invasion in chapter 2, verses 1 through 11. The alarm is given in verse 1. Blow a trumpet in Zion. And that trumpet there is what the Hebrews called the shofar. The shofar is usually a bent ram's horn that was blown for several reasons. Here you see a picture of it. This is in 1967 after Israel defeated Jordan in the Six-Day War. And this was Rabbi Shlomo, what's his last name? I can't remember right now. Gorin. Rabbi Shlomo Gorin at the Western Wall blowing the shofar horn. They had not been able to be at the Western Wall for a long, 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 long time at this point. But the real question is, and seriously, just without respect to the ram's horn, is what in the world are they doing at the Western Wall? Why are they not on the Temple Mount? Because that was under their control at the time. Why did they not go on the Temple Mount? So there's a lot of questions about that. But, of course, they gave up sovereignty of that, really, and now hardly any of them go on the Temple Mount. But they still go to the Western Wall. Here you can see the shofar. It's a bent ram's horn. There's a lot of significance to that in Judaism. But the shofar could be blown for several reasons. And the reason given here is given by the next phrase, a Hebrew parallelism. It's to sound an alarm on God's holy mountain. In Zion, on my holy mountain. That refers to the Temple Mount. That refers to the mount where Solomon's temple was located. It refers to the place today where you have the Dome of the Rock in the center. To the south, you have on the Temple Mount the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And on the north, running along the wall, just outside the wall, you have a Muslim school. If you don't get the picture, they're trying to take over the Temple Mount. You know, build every little thing they can on it to make sure that it's theirs and it's more difficult to get away from them. But at this time, it's obvious that there will be some tribulation temple here, and from that place, that holy mountain, Zion, they will blow the shofar. Let all the inhabitants of the land tremble. Let them quake, for the day of the Lord is coming. Now, this is the worst Holocaust of all human history, even far surpassing the global flood of Noah. Because in the global flood of Noah, everybody died in a relatively short period of time. You didn't have all these cataclysmic judgments spanned out over a period of 7 years, one after another, 21 judgments that we read about in Revelation, don't we? Surely it is near. Again, that's the Hebrew word kerob for imminence. This day is certain to occur, but it's uncertain when it will occur. Verse 2, a day of darkness and gloom, a day of clouds and thick darkness. Now, people like to get real spiritual at this point. Oh, yeah, darkness, obviously. It's going to be a very evil world, you know, and just the gloom means there's going to be a lot of spiritual depression and all that. Well, and that may be, but that's not what this is referring to. This is a literal, physical description of the cosmos during the tribulation. Look down at Joel 2:31 for a similar description. And this is not obviously spiritual. This is literal physical. The sun will be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the great and awesome day of the Lord comes. That is, before the day of the second coming. Joel 3:15. Skip down there. The sun and the moon grow dark and the stars lose their brightness. Now, Joel is not the only person who teaches this. This is all over the Bible. Turn to Zephaniah chapter 1. About 45 pages to the right. 60 pages. Somewhere. Zephaniah chapter 1, verse 15. This is all over the Bible. It really will be dark. It really will be gloomy. It really will be a day of clouds and thick darkness. Probably in most cases, the light of the sun will be impeded by something in the atmosphere. Zephaniah 1:15, a day of wrath is that day, a day of trouble and distress, a day of destruction and desolation, a day of darkness and gloom, a day of clouds and thick darkness. Now, if you turn over to Amos, which you had to go back to the left, if you turn back to Amos, right after Joel, Amos 5:18. A lot of Jews were longing for the day of the Lord. Oh, like it's going to be some kind of big party or something. Oh, it's going to be a lot of fun. But look at what Amos says in chapter 5, verse 18. Alas, you who are longing for the day of the Lord, for what purpose will the day of the Lord be to you? It will be darkness and not light. And, of course, this is a description of the tribulation period. There will be several blackouts during the tribulation. For the first blackout, turn to Revelation chapter 6, verse 12. To see that this is going to be a very physically dark period of history. Revelation 6, verse 12. Here we're looking at the sixth seal judgment. And I looked when he broke the sixth seal, and there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth made of hair, and the whole moon became like blood. Okay, that's what we call blackout number one in the tribulation. Blackout number two is in Revelation chapter 9, verse 2. He opened the bottomless pit, and smoke went out of the pit like the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened by the smoke of the pit. Okay, so that's what we call blackout of the sun number two. That is, the light of the sun cannot reach planet Earth. The third is in Revelation 16, verse 10. So we've had one in the seals, one in the trumpets. We also have one in the bowls. Revelation 16, verse 10. The fifth bowl. And incidentally, it's the sixth seal, the fifth trumpet, and then the fifth bowl. Then the fifth angel poured out, verse 10. Then the fifth angel poured out his bowl on the throne of the beast, and his kingdom became darkened. And they gnawed their tongues because of pain. So that's the final blackout. Okay. In the tribulation, if you turn to Matthew 24:29, you find out there is a blackout the very next day after the tribulation. The immediate day after that 7 years has expired, there will be another blackout. And that day, incidentally, is also the day of what? The second coming of Jesus Christ. Matthew 24. The Olivet Discourse, verse 29. But immediately after, there's the word after the tribulation of those days, after the 70th week of Daniel has expired, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And of course, then Jesus Christ returns. But there are many other passages that describe these cosmic phenomena of darkness. And that's exactly what Joel is talking about. that this is going to be, okay, go ahead and turn back to Joel 2, this is going to be cosmic in scale. Okay? It's not just going to be dark in one part of the world, it's going to be dark all, you're not going to have the sun to shine. Okay, on the earth. Middle of verse 2. As the dawn is spread over the mountains, so there's a great and mighty people. Now this is a difficult analogy, but just think of this way. When the sun is coming up, okay, on your side of the earth, think how it spreads illumination across all of planet earth. Okay, at that side of the earth, right? Okay, in other words, enlarge the mental imagery because you only see it in your local area and you think, hey, we're getting light. Enlarge it to think of everybody that is receiving on planet earth, on your side of the earth, in that time zone, is getting the light of the earth. Now, so in the same way, there's a great and mighty people. There is a great and mighty force coming across the surface of the entire earth. Okay, this is clearly global, just as the dawn is global. So this is the greatest army, numerically, ever to walk the face of the earth. Now, the question here, and many expositors disagree on a lot of these details, but the issue here is this. Is this another locust plague? You know, lots of commentators take that position that chapter 2 is describing another locust plague. And surely a lot of the language is locust-like. A second opinion says, no, this is a human army that came in the past. This is Assyria. And this is Babylon. And there's a third view, and it says, no, this is not locusts. This is not men. This is a demonic army. These are demons. And that's my view. I don't think there's much to vindicate a natural locust or ancient army here. This is something far beyond the natural. It's supernatural. It's global in scale, just as the dawn. Okay? Now, the obvious question everyone has then is, okay, well, why does it say people? There's a great and mighty people. And the answer to that question is that that word is AIM, A-M, long A. And it refers to the solidarity of a group, the unity of a group. There are a number of passages where this word has the sense of troops that march as a unit. 1 Samuel 11 is one of those, 11:11. And that's the description we're reading in Joel 2, verse 8, if you see. It says, they do not crowd each other. They march everyone in his path. They do not break ranks. See, they are functioning as a unit. And that's why the word AIM is used there, translated people. But it's not to designate them as humans necessarily. If I were to translate it in my own loose way, I would say a great and mighty force. That's the sense. I think they are a demonic force. Okay? But let me hearken to add very quickly that I don't think Joel's contemporaries could know from what is written here that it is a demonic force. I think you have to have the book of Revelation to know that. And they didn't have that. We have that new vantage point. They did not. Now he concludes verse 2 with these important words. There has never been anything like it, nor will there be again after it to the years of many generations. In other words, again, this is pointing to the global scale of the conflict. This is totally unique and totally unparalleled in human history. This is the ultimate Holocaust. When I did the math several years ago to calculate the death toll of Hitler's Holocaust as compared to the percentages of people killed in the book of Revelation, if you work those out, you have at the very minimum, one half of the earth's population decimated in the tribulation. And quite frankly, I think it's much closer to being total by the end of the tribulation. But taking the minimal, if one half of today's earth population were decimated, and you compare that to Hitler's 6 million Jews, then Hitler's 6 million Jews is just a drop in the bucket. 0.2%. 6 million is 0.2% of around 3 billion human people. So the death toll is completely unfathomable. I mean, Hitler's Holocaust is unfathomable. But to imagine 3 billion, 98.8% more human death is completely unfathomable to the human mind. So, but most importantly, this period is completely unique and unparalleled. And what we're to realize from this is, I hope you're realizing the hostility of sin. I hope you realize the violence of sin. The wickedness of sin as contrasted with the holiness of God. Sin is an outrage. It is detestable. It requires the strictest and most intense catastrophic judgments that humans can even imagine. Now, when is this unique period? This unparalleled period? Well, there are three other passages that talk about an unparalleled period of judgment. And in a sense, of course, there can be only one period of unparalleled judgment, then all three, four passages must be talking about the same period of history. The first one is Jeremiah 30. Turn to Jeremiah, one of the bigger prophets. Jeremiah 30, verses 5 through 7. Joel, Jeremiah, Daniel, and Jesus all talk about this unparalleled period of wrath. In Jeremiah 30, verse 5, "For thus says the Lord, I have heard a sound of terror, of dread. There is no peace. Ask now and see if a male can give birth. Why do I see every man with his hands on his loins, as a woman in childbirth? And why have all faces turned pale? Alas, for that day is great. There is none like it. None. And it is the time of Jacob's distress, but he will be saved from it." Okay, second, turn over to Daniel 12. Turn to the right from Jeremiah. Daniel 12, last chapter in Daniel. Chapter 12, verse 1. Now, Daniel is often thought of as a prophet. You know, oh, he's got all this prophetic stuff. But he was actually categorized by the Hebrews as a part of the wisdom literature. He was not in the prophets. He's not placed in the Nabiim in their categorization. He's placed in the Ketubim, the writings, the wisdom writings. And chapter 12, verse 1, Daniel was a man of wisdom. But here's one of his prophecies. "Now at that time, Michael, the great prince," we know this is the archangel Michael, "who stands guard over the sons of your people," that is Israel, he's the guardian of Israel, "will arise. And there will be a time of distress such as never occurred since there was a nation until that time. And at that time, your people, everyone who's found written in the book, will be rescued." Again, there's this note of positive note right at the end. Finally, Jesus spoke of this unparalleled time of distress in Matthew 24 again. Matthew 24 is a key text in the New Testament. The Olivet Discourse. Matthew 24, 21. We're trying to find out, when is this unparalleled period of time? Is it 7 years? Is it 5 years? What is it? Now, in Matthew 24, verse 15 sets the context with the act of the abomination of desolation you see there. Now, we know from Daniel 9, 27 that the abomination of desolation will take place at the midpoint of the tribulation. That is 3.5 years in. And then in verse 21, Jesus says this. Okay, "For then there will be a great tribulation such as has not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever will." So, Jesus coined the phrase great tribulation, and he limited it to the last 3.5 years of the tribulation. That is the unparalleled period of time, the unparalleled period of judgment. Both Daniel and Jesus indicated this was the second half of the tribulation, because that's when Michael comes into the picture at the midpoint. Now, that's why you cannot say this is a natural locust plague. You cannot say this is a human army of Assyria or Babylon. There has never been anything like it, nor will there ever be again after it. Now, there have been invasions much greater than Assyria or Babylon on Israel in ancient history. We've had them in this last century. We had World War II. We had World War I. These were conflicts that were much greater than those. So those can't be it. These have to be describing the second half of the tribulation, what Jesus called the Great Tribulation. Now, in Joel 2, verse 3, he goes on to talk about the devastation that this army will cause. Now, let's see if this sounds like a human army. Here's a description of what they do in the devastation. A fire consumes before them, and behind them a flame burns. So fire, the fire goes forth to destroy. And it says the land is like the Garden of Eden before them, before this great force. Now this shows, because in Joel's day he's exclusively talking about the land of Israel. In the tribulation, yes, it expands to talk about the whole globe. But here he's talking about the land of Israel. And if it's like the Garden of Eden before this great force, then this shows the agricultural development in the land of Israel. The land at this time will be fruitful, it will be productive, it will be blossoming. Now, if you were in the land of Israel about 150 years ago when Mark Twain visited and said, I don't know why anybody would care about this place, it's because what he was looking at was basically a swampland. I mean, nobody took care of it. Nobody cultivated it. Nobody developed it. It's not until 1948 when the Jews moved into the land that they began to develop and cultivate an agriculture and develop an economy. Now, in fact, currently, they are planning to develop the Negev, that southern part that's more desert-like. And that's where David Ben-Gurion was born, the first prime minister of Israel. He was born down in that southern section. And when he got out of his political career, he moved back to the Negev, and he became a farmer. You know, this is like, you know, Bill Clinton becoming a farmer or something. But he went back to develop that. So I think that the agricultural development of Israel that will result in this description is occurring right now as we speak. It says, but a desolate wilderness behind them. It's a Garden of Eden before them. It's a desolate wilderness behind them. Nothing at all escapes them. Verse 4 describes their appearance. Their appearance is like the appearance of horses. All right, they look like horses. How many humans do you know that look like horses? Hopefully not many. And like war horses, so they run. The humans that do look like horses, I don't think run like horses. Especially war horses. These are not humans. They're not horses. They're something like horses. They run like horses. Okay? The sound in verse 5. This is the sound they make. With a noise as of chariots. Now that is a deafening sound. A swarm of locusts is loud. But the sound of chariots is deafening. They leap on the tops of mountains. I don't know about you, but a lot of people try to climb these mountains around here. And I don't think they're just leaping on top of them. It takes a lot of effort. Like the crackling of a flame of fire consuming the stubble, like a mighty people arranged for battle. And notice it keeps using the prepositions like or as to indicate there's a similarity, but there's not an identity. This is something like a horse. They sound like a chariot. They're arranged like a mighty people. But they're not horses, they're not chariots, they're not people. Verse 6, here's the terror they evoke upon people. Before them the people are in anguish. This means the people writhe in fear. All faces are turned pale. In other words, they lose their color for fear, as when a person faints, you know, in the doctor's office because they've got to take blood or something. That'd be me. No, much worse. Okay, their speed and agility are described in verse 7. They run like mighty men. They climb the wall like soldiers. They each march in line, nor do they deviate from their paths. Now, this is describing the rapidity of the attack. Their agility in scaling obstacles. Their obedience to the task at hand. They do not turn aside from their mission, which we'll find out what that is in a minute. Verse 8 describes their discipline and their unity. They are disciplined and they are like one. They are aim, as verse 2 described them. They are a force that operates together. They do not crowd each other, he says. In other words, everybody is perfectly spaced out. Just think of a military. Okay? Think of the march. They march everyone in his path. When they burst through the defenses, they do not break ranks. So they are highly disciplined. They operate as a single force, like a single organism. This is what all military commanders want. You know, an army that will operate this way. Their attack is described in verse 9. They rush on the city. It's the city of Jerusalem. They run on the wall. They climb into the houses. They enter through the windows like a thief. Now, the language here is obviously a lot like a locust invasion. You know, they rush on the city. They run on a wall. They climb in houses. But here it's applied to this force. And the big question is, who are they? Turn to Revelation 9 quickly. This chapter describes the fifth and sixth trumpet judgments. We said when we studied the book of Revelation that in the first 3.5 years you have the six or seven seals. In the second half of the tribulation, that is the great tribulation, which we're talking about, you have the seven trumpets and the seven bowls. They all occur during the great tribulation. It's an escalation, an intense escalation of wrath during the tribulation. Exponential. Okay, by the end, it's the worst. So this is clearly the second half, as Joel 2:2 demands. This is the unparalleled day, the last 3.5 years. There's no other day like this one. And note the similarities starting in verse 16. I'm going to put up a graph just so you can see some of these similarities. The number, verse 16, of the armies of the horsemen was 200 million. I heard the number of them, John says. So we have a unified army of horsemen. Verse 15 says they're under the command of four fallen angels, which hints that all 200 million are actually fallen angels as well. Now, what did Joel describe? He said the army appears like horses. They run like horses. And here John describes this as an army of horsemen. Now, no one has ever seen an army of 200 million, but that would certainly fit with what Joel said when he said this is a mighty force that spreads out across the whole earth. And the goal of this army in Revelation 9 is the extermination of how much of the human race? 1/3 of the human race. At present, that would be approximately 2 billion people. Verse 17, there's more parallels. And this is how I saw in the vision the horses and those who sat on them. The riders had breastplates the color of fire and of hyacinth and of brimstone. And the heads of the horses... Heads of the horses are like the heads of lions, and out of their mouths proceed fire and smoke and brimstone. Now, I've never seen a horse like that. So this isn't a horse. This is something like a horse. It looks like a horse, but it's got other characteristics, too. Some people have tried to say these are the Chinese, you know. But as Arnold Fruchtenbaum said, a person would be hard-pressed to find just one Chinaman that looks like this, let alone 200 million. I mean, come on. Okay, clearly this force is being led by four fallen angels, and they themselves are fallen angels. So these are not literal horses. These horses breathe fire and smoke and brimstone. If you look at verse 19, they have these tails that are described like a serpent. They got a serpent for a tail, and off of that one serpent comes multiple heads. Okay, that's a lot of fun. The fire that comes out of their mouths would explain Joel 2:3, where Joel said the fire burned up everything before them and consumed everything behind them. Now this description here in Revelation 9 is also follows in verses 20 and 21 with a call to repentance. Just like the next section we'll deal with in Joel is followed by a call of the nation to repentance. So what I think is happening is that there are some striking similarities here. And Joel may not have known that this was demons and stuff, but it was something. Like a horse, sound like chariots, you know. He's getting a small picture. John is giving us an expanded picture. He's giving us more information, but they're talking about the same thing. They're talking about the sixth trumpet. All right, so we're going to have to stop there. I wanted to go back and do the blackout, but we don't have time to do that in chapter 2, verse 10. And then we'll get to the shocking conclusion there in verse 11. But just keep in mind that this is judgment for sin. This is judgment for Israel's sin. And it's a serious, serious thing with God. It's not a funny little thing, obviously. All right, well, let's close with a word of prayer.